You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. Oregon State Representative Cyrus Javidi has a Republican challenger. Javidi, a former Republican himself, announced in September that he would leave the Republican Party and run for re-election as a Democrat in next year's election. Now Christian Honnell, a member of Clatsop Care Center Health District Board, has filed to run as a Republican State House representative in District 32. Honnell is a retired Intel engineer and an Astoria native. He says he's running on a platform of safe communities, better infrastructure, addressing the housing crisis, and bringing back jobs to the area, especially in commercial fishing. He says that in District 32, which includes Clatsop, Tillamook, and Columbia counties, there are no jobs other than tourism, and that traditional industries like fishing and logging are overregulated. He believes Javidi, quote, flipped on the voters when he cast a deciding vote for a state transportation package and switched parties. Honnell says he wasn't considering running until that happened. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian, online at dailyastorian.com. On October 1st, certain Oregon State parks that had previously not required daily parking permits started charging for them. The Oregon Parks and Recreation Department says the decision comes out of a need to strengthen the long-term financial health of the parks. On Oregon's North Coast, this change impacted a number of popular sites. Near Warrenton, Fort Stevens State Park expanded existing fees to include all parking areas, while farther south, some sites began charging them for the first time. In-state residents now need to pay $10 for a daily permit. For out-of-state residents, the cost is $12. Ben Cox is the parks manager for the Nehalem Bay Management Unit, which includes popular sites like Cola State Park near Cannon Beach and Nehalem Bay State Park, among others. I spoke with him recently to learn more about the new fees at Tolovana Beach State Recreation Site and Oswald West State Park. Our conversation has been edited for length. Hello, Ben. We're going to dive right in. Could you give us more details about why the state is now charging these fees?
Sure. Something that's sort of not well known is that all of our day use parks across the department actually have a day use parking fee associated with them. The director has simply had the authority to waive those parking fees at a number of our properties and has done so for years. And so now what's happening is the director is removing some of those fee waivers in some of our parks, and it's really about revenue generation. What we're trying to do is reimagine state parks so we can protect the parks of today, but also provide new experiences and build a financially resilient future. We've had a little bit of a change in revenues. Oregon State Parks is supported primarily by RV registration fees, lottery dollars, and park user fees. And it's a little bit complicated when you really start seeing how the soup is made, but we have declining lottery revenue, and our share of that lottery revenue is actually lower now, and our park user fees haven't kept up. So we've seen two lines, and they're coming to a point where they're going to cross, which is our revenue and then the cost to operate the parks. We realized that we needed to do something to make sure that we're able to fund the parks into the future and keep the gates open and the lights on.
There is a different cost depending on if you're an Oregon resident or visiting from somewhere else. How is that determined and how is it enforced?
If you're paying via a credit card using the QR code signs that are in some of our parks, it'll simply ask you to put in your license plate and it'll calculate the appropriate fee. If you're paying at a park that has a ticket machine that dispenses a day-use parking pass, there's a selection. You select whether you're resident or non-resident. That fee, that non-resident fee, also applies to our annual parking permit as well. We're really relying on people to be honest and sort of the goodwill of our guests. We feel like most people recognize what we have to offer is valuable in their lives and is a valuable service. In a perfect world, I think if our director, I won't speak for her, but I think if she had it her way, we wouldn't charge a fee at all, because we want people to come and enjoy these places. But the reality is that we have to care for them, and we are not supported by tax revenue at all.
What kind of response have you heard to the parking fees?
The response at Tolovana has been fairly neutral. We haven't had a lot of negative comments. There haven't been a lot of positive comments. The interactions with the rangers have been just typical of what we've seen in other day use fee parks, parking fee parks that have charged the fee for some time. A lot of people are curious. They sort of want to know, why are we doing this? You know, where is this money going? Oswald West was supposed to be in that batch of parks that rolled out October 1st. Oswald West is challenging because there's really very little cellular service there, and there's no electricity at the park. So that park is getting ticket dispensing machines, and so that's added infrastructure that we have to put in place. We have culturally sensitive areas that we need to consult with a variety of people before we excavate. And so we had to go through that process.
Switching gears only slightly, but it's going to circle back around to what we're talking about. During the height of the COVID-19 pandemic and during various lockdown restrictions, the Oregon coast saw a huge influx of visitors, especially to state parks. What are you seeing now?
Yeah, so the post-pandemic day use attendance is still much greater than pre-pandemic. 2021 was still sort of the high mark on the curve. That was just intensely crazy. Attendance did fall off compared to 2021 over the next couple of years, but was still very high. 2025, anecdotally, seems to be tracking right along with that. I think there was a lot of pent-up demand and a discovery of, hey, there are these cool places. We can't go to Disneyland, so let's run out to the coast. And people discovered that and put that in their back pocket, so to speak, and it has become a favorite thing to do. So we're still seeing a lot of folks showing up at the beach more than before the pandemic. The type of recreation, I think we're seeing more people show up for photo opportunities or there's a lot of interest in special events. People want to have a wedding, or they want to, you know, set up a guided hike or something of that nature. Previously, it just felt like a lot of people would come to the coast and sort of post up, right? So they'd bring their beach chairs down and their blankets and a picnic lunch and toys for the kids and just sort of spend the day at the beach. And there's still plenty of that. But I think I've seen an increase in people sort of coming and going a little bit more. They want to come to Hug Point, for example, and maybe go down and see the waterfall and experience tide pools. And then they're moving on.
So my follow-up question is there any sense that with the new day use fees, those might change how or when or even if people show up?
No, we don't get that sense. And I'll tell you something that we see that sort of points to that, which is in an effort to keep people safe and to ease the burden on the resource, we really started to focus a lot on where people were parking and their behavior, sort of trying to keep everybody friendly and respectful of the resource. That involved a lot of partnership with local law enforcement, with Oregon State Police, and then our commissioned enforcement rangers. A lot more citations have been written in the past 3 years. And what we've seen is if somebody is parked inappropriately and they receive a citation for $110, the mindset is sort of, hey, I came out for Portland. It's pay to play. I'm here. I'll just eat the ticket because I've got a spot here and I'm at the beach I want to be at, so I'm good. And so with folks sort of willing to incur that sort of financial burden, the $10 daily permit just doesn't feel like that's going to be prohibitive.
That was Ben Cox with the Nehalem Bay Management Unit talking about new park fees at state parks. Mothers and their babies in Washington state will have access to food benefits through the end of the month, even though the federal government remains shut down. Earlier this month, officials with the Washington Department of Health said the Women, Infants, and Children Program, or WIC, had only 1 or 2 weeks' worth of funding to keep feeding low-income Washingtonians. The newfound money is coming from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, not the state. But it was not immediately clear how much money the federal government was providing or where it was being funneled from. The Trump administration has said recently it would use revenue from tariffs to keep the program running while the government is shut down. Even with the additional funding, Washington State has seen temporary closures of WIC clinics. In Washington, over 200 clinics serve more than 200,000 women and their children under 5 years old annually under the WIC program. WIC helps nearly one-third of all newborn babies. Nationally, the program serves nearly 7 million Americans. The story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer. Online at chinookobserver.com. It's been 3 years since Oregon legislators passed a law requiring employers pay overtime to farm workers. But as OPB's Alejandro Figueroa reports, some farm workers say they're making less money, not more. And growers say they can't afford to pay the overtime.
Maria de Lourdes Navarro is used to being up early. On a late summer afternoon, she's back home after waking up at around 5 in the morning. It's grape harvest season in the Willamette Valley. For Navarro and her adult son, that means grab some coffee, be at the job site by 7 in the morning. There, they'll haul around heavy buckets of grapes they cut by hand, and they'll usually be back home by early afternoon.
When we get back, we wash our dirty gloves, and work clothes need to be set aside. We don't have a washing machine here, so we have to do laundry elsewhere. I then get that out of the way, and then I cook.
These days, Navarro and her son are working 48 hours a week, more or less. Just 3 years ago, though, they were working way more, sometimes up to 70 hours a week during the busiest weeks in the summer. And Navarro says she's starting to feel it.
Last year, I earned less than the year before last. I remember because you can tell from your taxes.
Under a federal law passed in 1938, agricultural workers are excluded from receiving time and a half pay. It was a Jim Crow era compromise to keep cheap farm labor in the South. In 2022, the state of Oregon passed a law to extend that overtime to farm workers with a multi-year phase-in. This year, overtime kicks in after someone works 48 hours, and by 2027, it will kick in after 40 hours. Reina Lopez is the executive director of Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste, or PECUN, a farm worker advocacy group in Woodburn.
All workers should be treated with dignity and respect, and that does mean ensuring that they have safe working conditions and that they're paid a living wage.
Lopez says Oregon's farm worker overtime law was meant to equal the playing field for agricultural workers. And in a way, she says, it keeps people safe.
As we know, farm work is extremely taxing on the body. And a lot of what our fundamental goal around this was to ensure that people didn't have to work 7 days a week to make a living.
Many agricultural workers clock in 60 or 70 hours a week during the peak of summer. That can significantly increase the chances of workplace accidents or injuries. But Navarro sees the downside.
I totally agree that if we could work 8 hours a day and be able to comfortably pay our rent and bills, we would be happy.
Instead, she's being asked to work shorter hours for the same hourly wage as before the law changed. It's not just farm workers that are in a tight spot. So are farmers. If you ask Max Coleman, he'll say farm work doesn't fit into the normal 9-to-5, 40-hour work week.
The difference is, for us, there's also a perishable element. You know, if you have tomatoes or hops sitting outside, they're only good for a certain amount of time, so they have to get picked in that time.
His family primarily grows hops near St. Paul. Not only do crops have to be picked during a specific window, but the cost of labor is high. For Coleman, it accounts for about 40% of the total cost to produce his crop. His employee's average wage is $20 an hour. At time and a half pay for overtime, his margins get slimmer, and he doesn't get to raise the price to make up the difference.
I can't go out and sell my hops for more because there's somebody in Germany or there's somebody elsewhere in the U.S. that can compete and bring my price down.
It's why farm groups are lobbying state lawmakers to raise the overtime cap to 50 hours or exempt it altogether in the summer during the peak of harvest. Reina Lopez at PECUN says not all workers she represents are willing to take that compromise.
And what they said to me was, pues, ¿cuál es el beneficio para el trabajador? What is the benefit for the worker? And for many of us, it goes back to the same thing. You're asking us to do a really hard job at the peak of harvest, which is the summer.
I asked Navarro what she thought about it.
Pienso yo que tal vez hubiese un punto medio.
She says maybe there should be a middle ground. 50 hours sounds good. Now, the question is whether lawmakers might take another look at Oregon's farm worker overtime law. I'm Alejandro Figueroa, reporting.
And now we have the public meeting logs for KMUN's listening area. Starting off in Oregon and Clatsop County, the Warrenton City Commission meets today at 6 p.m. Among other things, the commissioners will listen to a presentation about a solid waste rate study and consider a request to advertise bids for bank stabilization at Seafarers Park. City commissioners will also consider hiring a lobbyist at the state level to help assist with a funding request for Warrenton's new wastewater treatment plant. The city is hoping to land $3 to $10 million through the state and other funding mechanisms. In Tillamook County, the Wheeler City Council and Planning Commission will hold a work session from 6:15 to 8:15 p.m. to discuss a waterfront overlay zone. The Nehalem City Council holds their regular meeting at 6 p.m. On Wednesday, still in Tillamook, the Port of Tillamook Bay meets at 3 p.m. On the agenda is a discussion and consideration of raising water rates to accommodate increasing wholesale rates from the city of Tillamook. The port provides water to its customers by purchasing that water from the city of Tillamook. The port commissioners also plan to meet in executive session to discuss real property transactions. This portion of the meeting will be closed to the public, but the commissioners are not supposed to vote on any decisions while in the closed session. You're listening to KMUN News. As always, if you have a news tip or a story idea, please get in touch. Email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and the KMUN News Team, which includes host and producer Skylar Butenshin, myself, KMUN News Director Katie Frankowitz, and our intern, Sylvia Thorpe. Our news broadcasts air on KMUN Monday through Thursday, beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening. That's all from us today. We'll see you tomorrow.